This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So this problem in Sudan is exacerbating what is happening in both Central African Republic and Chad. And so peace in Sudan is very critical for these two countries.
That's Professor John Mokum Mbaku, senior fellow at Brookings, talking about the negative impact Sudan's current conflict could have on neighboring countries. Details coming up also. More protests are planned today in Guinea after organizers said 7 people were killed yesterday. And the summit of the BRICS countries in August is expected to consider new members. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Reuters and local sources report today that Sudan's warring military factions have been making progress in peace talks and are close to signing a humanitarian truce. Khalid Omar Yusuf, former Sudan's Minister of Cabinet Affairs in the last civilian-led administration, told VOA's sister media organization, Arabic-language TV Al-Hora, that the parties are close to agreeing to a ceasefire that would allow the delivery of humanitarian assistance and protection of civilians. He spoke from Khartoum, where the last truce has been overcome by fierce, renewed fighting, while the talks in the Saudi towns of Jeddah are in their sixth day. Sudan's conflict between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces is in its fourth week. Residents in the capital Khartoum report fierce fighting even as the parties continue to negotiate a humanitarian truce. As we just reported, the opponents in Sudan's deadly clashes seem determined to continue fighting despite repeated calls for peace from around the globe. The stalemate is worrying for Sudan's neighbors, particularly Chad, which shares a 1,300-kilometer boundary with Sudan and the Central African Republic. Professor John Mokum Mbaku, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, tells me that unless there is peace in Sudan, the economies of these countries like Chad and South Sudan could falter.
The relationship between Chad and Sudan is that even after independence of the two countries, if you look at the boundaries, what you see is that the boundaries are very porous. People have been crossing from one area to another for centuries. And as far as the people in Central African Republic and Sudan on the boundary are concerned, they really don't see any boundary. And so what has happened is that whenever there has been political instability or hunger in either country, people have crossed from one border to another. According to the UN Refugee Agency, a little over 30,000 refugees have already crossed from Sudan into Chad, and they expect more to cross, Sudanese to cross into Chad. Chad already is host to 600,000 refugees, 400,000 of whom are from Sudan's Darfur region. So, and in addition to that, Chad has about 400,000 people who are internally displaced because of the political problems that have been happening in Chad. And unless there is peace in Sudan, the economy of Chad is going to literally collapse from this weight of refugees that are flowing in from Sudan. With respect to Central African Republic, more Sudanese are crossing from Sudan into Central African Republic. And that is compounded, that problem is compounded by the fact that the Central African Republic has 500,000 internally displaced people. About 750,000 Central Africans have fled to neighboring countries, including Sudan. About 3 million Central Africans are facing acute food insecurity. So this problem in Sudan is exacerbating what is happening in both Central African Republic and Chad. And so peace in Sudan is very critical for these two countries in terms of not just the flow of refugees, but also in terms of food insecurity.
Now, moving forward, we have bordering countries like Egypt, Libya, and then we have the DRC and South Sudan. it all comes down to Port Sudan. What is the significance of Port Sudan for many of the surrounding countries?
Well, Port Sudan is a major transit area for goods and services coming into the region and going out of the region. For a country like South Sudan, Port Sudan is a lifeline. And the reason is that 90% of South Sudan's public revenues come from oil. And that oil leaves South Sudan through a pipeline that goes all the way to Port Sudan. So if Port Sudan is not functioning, South Sudan can literally be strangled financially because it will not be able to export its oil and it will not be able to get other supplies that come from around the world through the port of Sudan. For other countries in the region, Port Sudan is very important for countries like Central African Republic, for example. Port Sudan is very important for imports that are coming from around the world. And so if Port Sudan ceases to function as it has as a result of the conflict that is happening in Sudan now, that is going to have a very significant economic impact on the neighboring countries to Sudan.
Top officials from the United States and Saudi Arabia are involved in a push for a ceasefire in Sudan through this a U.S.-Saudi initiative. Do you think that will bring about peace to the region?
The effort is a good effort. The only thing that we have to be very careful is that whenever external forces come to Africa to preach peace, African countries, including Sudan, of course, have to be very careful, primarily because those external forces, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and other external countries have their own objectives in the area. So one of the things that I would say here is that a much more plausible way to resolve the problem in Sudan would be for the African Union to take the lead and coordinate the assistance that is being given by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. so that in the process, the interest of the Sudanese people will be made an important part of the discussion.
That was Professor John Makum Mbaku, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, speaking with me by phone from the U.S. state of Utah. The U.N. is preparing for more than 860,000 people to flee the fighting in Sudan and neighboring Chad, as we just reported, has already received more than 30,000 refugees. Aid groups struggling to cope with the sudden influx say they'll have to stop aid in Chad altogether this month if they do not receive more funding, as Henry Wilkins reports from Kufarun, Chad.
The UN's World Food Programme, or WFP, distributes food on Chad's border with Sudan. Sudan's conflict between its military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has triggered intercommunal violence in western Darfur, just a kilometre away, according to the UN Human Rights Commission. Satahir Mohamed Abdullah is an English teacher from Jenina in western Darfur. 3 weeks ago, he says armed men he believes are aligned with the RSF rode into his town on horses, camels and motorbikes, burning and looting homes and killing residents. He says the power struggle between the RSF and the Sudanese army at the heart of the conflict means men like this can now act with impunity.
Everyone wanted to be a president in Sudan. That is their problem, but there is another people. There is another people, they are thieves. It's a groups of thieves, and they are with the vice president. And if you have like cars, they can take your car. If you have goods in the shop, they can come and take your goods. If you refuse, they can kill you.
He fled with his wife and children, arriving here in Kafrun, Chad, where he and his family now take refuge from 40-degree heat in this tiny shelter. Now that he is here, he faces a new threat. Aid workers say the situation for refugees in Chad was dire, even before the Sudan conflict broke out last month. The WFP plans to halt all assistance for over 700,000 refugees and internally displaced people in Chad this month because of a lack of funding, according to a Reuters report Tuesday. Before the civil war, Chad hosted hundreds of thousands of Sudanese refugees as a result of years of violence in neighbouring Darfur. Pierre Honorat is the WFP country director for Chad. He says the refugees from the Sudan conflict are putting even more strain on what little is left.
It's alarming, it's critical. So today, on top of those, on top of that food insecurity that you have in Chad, you have now all those newcomers, which is putting a lot of stress on the host population.
El Saida Ibrahim Mohamed Adam says she arrived in Kafrun with her baby on her back, and her journey was fraught with danger. She says she feels safe from the armed groups in Sudan, at least, but people here are desperate.
There is no food, water, or blankets. Some refugees don't have enough to eat. 9 or 10 families have to share tiny portions of food. There are children here. A mother gave birth to her child and then died, so there are newborns and elderly people, as well as diseased and injured people. Many children are starving. They don't even have anything to wear. They have no place to shield themselves from the heat of the sun or the gusts of wind.
As it stands, no more aid is coming for Adam and her family. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kafrun, Chad.
And in more news from Sudan, UN experts are calling for impartial and independent investigations into the atrocities committed against civilians in Sudan by two rival armed forces. The plea came at a special session of the UN Human Rights Council to address the impact of the ongoing conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Since fighting erupted April 15th between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. An estimated 700,000 people have been displaced inside Sudan, and more than 150,000 refugees have fled for safety to neighboring countries. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk condemned the military coup, which he said was jointly carried out by the commanders of the two competing forces, General Al-Burhan and General Dagalo. He said the fighting triggered by the two men has plunged the country into catastrophe and once again has crushed the hope for transition to full civilian rule and democracy.
I strongly condemn this wanton violence in which both sides have trampled international humanitarian law, notably the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution. Today, immense damage has been done, destroying the hopes and rights of millions of people.
Turk said it was essential that both parties urgently commit to an inclusive political process and to a negotiated peace. He called on the generals to establish a humanitarian truce to allow life-saving aid to reach the many victims deprived of food, water, medical care, and other vital relief. The chair of the Coordination Committee of Special Procedures, Taleng Mofokeng, called on the warring parties to immediately end the fighting and to stop targeting the civilian population and infrastructure. She said urgent measures were needed to tackle the worsening humanitarian crisis. She said it was important to investigate and document violations and to hold perpetrators accountable for their crimes.
We urge the immediate initiation of independent and impartial investigations into the loss of civilian lives, injuries sustained by individuals, and cases of ill treatment and other gross human rights violations inflicted upon humanitarian personnel, healthcare workers, human rights defenders, journalists, as well as attacks on civilian infrastructure.
Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Hassan Hamid Hassan, questioned why the Council was in such a rush to hold this ad hoc session, especially as it had received no support from any African or Arab country. He added the protection and promotion of human rights has always been and always would remain a priority for his government. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. An anti-government movement said it was planning new demonstrations in Guinea today after its leaders reported at least 7 protesters were shot dead and 32 injured yesterday. Reuters News reports police in riot gear cracked down on demonstrators who threw rocks and burned tires in yesterday's protest, the latest against the military government that seized power in 2021 and has been slow to hand over power back to civilians. small-scale protests also took place in Nzirikori, a town in the southeast, and in the central town of Dabalo. Opposition parties and civil society groups said late yesterday that in addition to the injured, 56 arrests were reported. Reuters said the government has not responded to the allegations. There have been several protests in Guinea since the military took power, some of which have turned deadly following clashes with security forces. The country's military government is one of several in West Africa that took power in a string of coup d'etats since 2020 and are slow in fulfilling election promises. High on the agenda at the summit of the BRICS countries in August is the group's possible expansion. The BRICS countries are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, some of the world's most powerful developing economies. The South African government, which is hosting the summit, says new countries are applying every day to join BRICS. Darren Taylor reports.
South African officials say 13 countries have asked formally to join BRICS, including Iran and Saudi Arabia, while informal requests have come from Algeria, Argentina, Bahrain, Indonesia, Nigeria, and United Arab Emirates. Johannesburg-based governance consultant Dr. Charles Sinkala has no doubt that BRICS is about to grow substantially. He says it's already much more representative of what he calls the true state of the world than the United Nations and other groups like the G20.
If you look at the numbers of the BRICS countries, they are about 3.3 billion in terms of population. The capacity of their GDP is compared to almost half of the world's population GDP in terms of economic activities. So the prospects of being part of the BRICS organization, they are actually very high. That's why you see...
Sinkala says an economic alliance of countries previously regarded as weak makes sense.
You know, the world has been dominated with only the few individuals or countries from the West who has monopolized the financial services assistance to countries such as the World Bank, the IMF, who has very stringent conditions in terms of giving money to certain countries, and many other issues, including the denial of Africa to have a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council. I think this comes as an alternative.
Whatever this alternative BRICS looks like in the end, says Sinkala, it'll transform world politics forever and severely weaken the UN and the West, economically and politically. An expanded BRICS could leave it poised to replace the non-aligned movement. This collective of 120 countries was established in 1961, mainly as a response to the Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union. The movement resolved not to align with either side. Its profile has slipped in recent years. Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, Richard Wolff, told a recent webinar organized by the Democracy at Work group, a new BRICS would herald the emergence of a new world economic empire.
These are the realities that we face. And that means we also have to face the reality that an immense global working class is emerging, shrinking and suffering in the West, explosively growing in the East and in the global South. And that's going to change everything as the capitalists in the West hunker down, worrying about how long they can survive. The emerging power of the capitalism of the East, the nationalism gripping them, and the state-private hybrid that is their way of coping with the time ahead.
Some analysts see an expanded BRICS as an overt military threat to the West, led by China and Russia in particular. A threat that would be very real were anti-Western nuclear powers such as Iran and North Korea to join. But Sinkala says that assessment is too simplistic and too negative.
There's an option as well of an organization that can look at the economics of the activities of nations. If you look at BRICS itself, they have already developed a BRICS bank headquartered in China.
That bank is part of a BRICS-led effort to bypass the US dollar in international trade transactions. This has gained impetus since the West imposed sanctions on Russia because of its invasion of Ukraine. The sanctions make it difficult for Moscow's trade partners to do business with Russia, which is rich in energy resources. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Rights groups are urging Nigerian authorities to suspend the resettlement of people who fled Islamic militants in the country's northeast. Borno state authorities have relocated most camps for displaced people, but critics say security and basic needs are not being met. Timothy Obiezu reports from Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Zara Malam had lived in a makeshift camp in Maiduguri since 2017 when she fled attacks on her village of Sigal. But in June, the Borno state government shut the camp and offered to resettle the internally displaced people, or IDPs, living there back home. Malam says she was not convinced of her safety, so she relocated to Ran, a community that houses thousands of IDPs under constant military watch. She says the government has been helping them, but since it decided to send them back home, she came to this place. Even if there was no security threats, she would have nothing to return to. All her relatives are dead. Borno State is the epicenter of Nigeria's grueling, nearly 15-year battle with armed militants. State authorities began shutting down camps in May 2021 and have been supporting evacuees with food and cash. The government says that with improving security in recent years, it wants to rebuild Borno State and reduce high dependence on aid. But rights group Human Rights Watch argues that an estimated 200,000 IDPs could be adversely affected and wants the government to consider the consequences. Anietie Ewang is a researcher at Human Rights Watch.
We're also quite concerned that, you know, this action might go beyond Maiduguri and put many other internally displaced people across the state, which has suffered, you know, devastating impact from the Boko Haram conflict at risk.
According to International Organization for Migration Survey, only 15% of the IDPs were willing to relocate on the grounds of improved security. The survey also shows nearly 50% of the evacuees returned to their home villages because they had no other choice. Mathias Shimali is the UN resident and humanitarian coordinator.
We understand, on the one hand, the intentions that are behind this, but of course worry about whether the 130,000 so far have ended up in a better place. So, you know, these kinds of movements of people should be voluntary, should be dignified, and should be based on informed choices.
Many humanitarian organizations halted food and cash distribution after the government announced the camp closures. Aid groups in Borno, like Action Against Hunger, say they are already seeing serious malnutrition issues. Ahmed Odewale is the group's deputy head of nutrition.
Reports coming from our various supporting aid facilities in the northeast have shown a steady increase in the number of cases, even though we are not in the lean season.
For now, many here are just hoping the government doesn't close any more camps. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Maiduguri, Borno State, Nigeria.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.